these things the public is not questioning. And what needs to be done, the people have to logically think about these things and say, hey, wait a minute. What is it, an insult to our intelligence? Write letters there. Let's find out what they have. We want to have the tools because we pay for it. Our tax money supports all this. So therefore, we should know, at least know what is going on.
Well, I think that's really important. I don't criticize you for doing what you're doing, writing your book or anything. But, again, I don't think it would be controversial for scientists to support the existence of some sort of atmosphere on the moon if they believe that to be the case. It's not the same as saying there are advanced life forms on the moon. I could see them holding back from that.
Mm-hmm.
We don't either, Greg. It's a good question.
Well, I hope the astronomers get together. As right now, for every 1,000 astronomers students that leave the colleges, only one finds a job and 999 are driving taxis. I'm sure the one that finds a job is very cautious of making any rational statements that would jeopardize his position. And so in the scientific community, there is a... do not make wave principle, and we know this. It has been proven many times. So nobody really wants to stick their neck out because it deals with a new idea, and anybody on Earth ever that came up with new ideas, whether it was Edison, Marconi, Steinmetz, Curie, all these people, they were called crackpots because they dared to come up with new ideas. They had nothing but arguments and fights all their life to bring something better to society.
All right, with that, Greg, I'm going to have to let you go.
You.
We've got a lot of calls behind you here. But appreciate your questions, really do.
Sure.
Thank you very much. KBC time now is about 36 minutes past the 11 o'clock mark. We're talking to Fred Steckling about those alien bases on the moon, some strange things going on there. And we'll be back with our questions in just a moment.
Down subsequent to his trip to the moon, i.e. maybe now discharged from the Air Force and the Air Force can talk, maybe it was what he saw that was other than... he was expected to report or had been expected to expect. Remember which one it was?
Yes, I know.
They had a TV movie on him, and they showed it like, oh, he had this great moment, and he couldn't adjust to being just another person on Earth afterwards.
Well, you know, the strangest thing is that just the very moment when Apollo 11 returned from the Earth, from the moon back to the Earth, the four top scientists at the Houston Receiving Laboratory all resigned. Top geologists, lunar geologists, up all the names in my book. And they all resigned at the finest hour, would you believe, after years of hard work. Why?
Well, I'm glad you bring this out because I believe that this Air Force personnel that had sighted UFOs, they were told, many they couldn't usually talk about it until they got out of the Air Force. So, and it is also true that otherwise people would say, you know, we none of us trust our politicians, but we say, do something, right? What could they be doing? But the other thing was, you commented that the Quran was referring to the moon as a reflection or an illusion. Now, it is not in contrast to the belief of Christians or Judeo-Christian belief, because God made everything, you see. He made the heaven and the earth. Now, if they originally thought heaven is just that space up above, we know that for a long time. But that is no contradiction.
No, that's true. That's not contradictory. No.
And all things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Now, most Christians do believe that there are people out there. I mean, planets and inhabitants and so forth. So find a few Christians you can talk about it from that angle.
I have many times.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's one other thing yet. Now, obviously, you mentioned earlier that they abandoned all plans of mining the moon, right? Because someone was already doing it. So that is another proof that this is really a deliberate. Obviously, if we started mining up there too, they might boost us off, right?
Well, possible. You see, when these photographs were returned, the experts had quite a problem because they identified some of them to be volcanic.
Yeah.
And some of them meteoric. But many of them couldn't be explained either that or the other, and they don't know how they got there. And perhaps giving them a hint that there are mining craters, that will explain what is going on there.
Oh, so they were not made by meteorites or whatever makes
them. Not some of them. A lot of them were, yes, and yes.
Well, this is one other thing now. We have shortages of minerals and precious substances on this earth, so it has crossed my mind earlier why was nothing done. Well, then someone will say, oh, but the gravity. Now, you already say the gravity is not as great, or is greater than it was supposed to be.
It's a little higher than what we thought.
Yes. Well, now, that is kind of hard to get away from, you know. I mean, if you take off with a loaded... spaceship weighing so many tons, they probably don't have the jet engines yet to boost it away.
Well, we need a new technology, obviously,
right.
Something
and,
magnetic
and
or something.
It's not really feasible in anyone's lifetime, and nobody looks much beyond that.
You'd be surprised what can happen in a lifetime.
I know. Look at Mr. Stirling. Only an individual could do something like that. You see, this is it. Like he said, everybody's afraid to stick their neck out. It does, and I do commend you, and I will let my followers have the rest of the time. But it is a wonderful thing that someone devotes practically his whole life something like the moon. I'm very heartened.
Well, thank you for your call, Hilda.
Thank you.
Good night.
Appreciate that. Okay, I think we have Hernando on the line. Hello there, Hernando.
Good evening, Bill and Fred.
Yes.
My name is Hernando. Fred, do you know whether our Department of Defense has in their premises any of the hundreds of UFOs that have been sighted in the States, and also whether they have a chance to capture any of the forms of intelligence that operate the UFOs while they were still alive?
Well, I have I've heard many, many stories, of course, of spacecraft that have crashed on Earth, all the way back to the 1940s when we first exploded the nuclear weapons in Wright Central Mexico. Reports have come to me that parts of spacecraft were dismantled and taken to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and kept there. Obviously, the movie industry picked this up, too, and they produced this movie, Hangar 18, I believe.
Hangar 18.
Oh, yes. So, to tell you exactly where these spacecraft are, how much we have learned, I don't know, really. At this point, it's all very classified. But I can assure you that if we have spacecraft in our possession, that we have learned much in the field of science and the combinations of metals and so forth that we can use in our own space program, which has been very beneficial to the people so far.
As far as capturing or finding any beings that were alive, there are some stories that some did live for just a little while, but generally they had passed on by the time we got to them.
What type of forms did they have? Were they like, you know, more or less like we or what?
Well, we did quite a story on this with Lynn Stringfield not too long ago. By and large, they are the little people that are about 4 feet high. In fact, the descriptions of them were used by Mr. Spielberg in developing his people in First Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
There are a number of those. Others look just like we, and there are some exotic-looking ones.
Well, whatever these movies bring out, they all have a good purpose, and they make us aware of the fact that regardless of how they may look like, they still could be our friends.
Mm-hmm.
Just like in this movie right now, E.T., you know. So we should have an open mind, and just because something looks different, you know, that doesn't mean that...
You're smart enough to get here, and we can't get off the planet to speak of.
However, I haven't seen those movies, but what kind of brain forms do they have, the ones that were captured alive? Do you know?
Well, they're probably very much like ours, but more developed. So we have... We only use 7 or 8% of the capacity of our minds, and all the other 90% are wasted so far. We haven't made use of it yet, so you can imagine what we can do when we make use of it.
And getting back to the UFOs itself, what kind of power source were they using in order to propel them through, outer space?
So far, what we have found is that these are vehicles of electromagnetic and electrostatic propulsion methods, and they are using magnetic fields. First of all, they nullify the gravitational field around the craft to take off the planet, and then in space they tune in into the magnetic fields. To explain that, if you visualize a pond, a still pond, and you drop a pebble into this pond, ripples of waves extend from that center point into space, and these magnetic fields are very much identical from planet to planet, from sun to sun, and the spacecraft use this type of propulsion method. That would be free energy, something that we could all use on Earth that would get rid of our pollution problems and all the other problems. But then economically, I'm sure at the very moment, we are not ready for such a change.
Although it's underway.
But it is underway.
It is underway. It's already being marketed and very limited.
Mm-hmm. A while back when I was listening and seeing the broadcast of the first landing of mankind on the moon, there were these broadcast from the moon to Houston that they keep saying something about bogey. Did that have something to do with the UFO itself? Because like when you like tape them and you like kind of playing back, you get all these different terminology.
Yeah, there was a lot of terminology used that gave every kind of indication that they did see bogeys. They described them, following them along. Apollo 12 certainly had a lot of things following it along, and you can watch the conversations for that. There was the curious code names of Anbel and Barbara, which they saw quite often. We feel that those were code names for buildings and machines and structures on the moon.
Right.
Okay, Hernando, does that help you?
Yeah, Bill, I wanted to ask you, at the end of the program, can you give me your address so I could send a self-addressed stamp envelope?
Oh, here to the radio station, 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard, 90016.
Okay, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Good night.
Thank you, good night.
So I take your
Bible. Hey, how are you?
All right.
Good. I have some really interesting questions here. First of all,
I want you to make it quick. Try to get as many as we can in here, okay?
What are the objectives of these beings for mining our moon? And if it's energy, then how does the stability of our nation, in other words, our interest, our nations, our interest in annihilating one another for energy, have and what type of effect does that have on these life forms' interest in mining the moon? Does that make sense?
Well, all right. I don't think that we have anything to do with that. We, at the very moment, are not exploring the moon. We cannot claim it. It's not ours. It just orbits the Earth, and anybody that is coming from somewhere and finds some metals or minerals they need, they can mine it just like we when we land there.
Okay, but is it possible that they're mining it for energy, like we're looking for oil on other parts of our Earth?
It's very much possible, yes.
Okay, so
yeah, because the NASA returns of the makeup of the lunar soil, and the rocks shows an immense amount of minerals, a wealth of minerals that can be used for construction and manufacturing. And for instance, Mr. Heppenheimer in his book Colonies on Space some years ago says that immense cylinders, miles in length, have been planned, whenever we get the money ready for it, to be built entirely from the material from the moon that will be mined there by us and then driven into space by mass drivers or other vehicles, and then the constructions are constructed with moon material entirely.
Then it's possible that these beings are depleted of energy wherever they're from, and then they've come this far to look for it then. Is that true?
May not. It may be that they are respecting nature and don't want to destroy their own planet and mine it and deplete it, and so they go to satellites which have little life forms left. You know, for instance, if the moon, I will make this clear, the moon is not a place like the Earth. There are oases on the moon where life may be possible, and where atmosphere exists in the lower valleys and craters, a denser atmosphere than we have been told. But the moon is a desolated place in some areas, and certainly a perfect place for mining.
Okay, well,
certainly makes more sense to mine there than it does in your own backyard. In
very
other
true.
Words.
Right, I understand that. But then would that have any effect on us? In our future,
and not really.
Being the fact that we can't even get to the moon. Well, we've gotten to the moon, but we can't even we're still trying to get anti-gravity working and all this type of thing.
Well, what we can do is we can go there and we can acknowledge their existence and work together with them, and then have an exchange and a trade going on an interplanetary basis. And
I see.
That would be a terrific thing.
Nice.
Yes.
Yeah, that would be great. Of course, on the other hand, Fred, they may not want us up there.
Maybe not. Right.
And it isn't ours. If they're up there working it right now, it'd be very hard to claim it.
That's true.
That brings other questions, but I guess I'll have to wait for another time.
Okay, fine.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Henry. Appreciate the call. We have time for maybe one or two more. Chris, you on the line?
Yes.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
Okay. Well, I've been waiting quite a while, and
a
lot of questions have been asked. No, it's all right. I appreciate it. I feel the privilege to be on the air talking with you. And I just want to ask this question. I want to know if Fred knows, has there been any kind of contact between us and them out there? Do you know of any through your research?
Oh, yes, I have read a lot. I've met a lot of interesting people. I have gone into publications that that justify such a statement. For instance, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs makes a statement there in the physics book that alien visitors from the UFOs may be from other planets, and that they have been visiting the Earth since biblical days, and that they have probably made contact with us in different levels of awareness, whatever that means. People that are aware of the possibility they exist, so they're not afraid, perhaps officials that are afraid to make statements to the public, and perhaps simple people that are not believed when they come out. There have been authors that have written books on UFOs, and they were ridiculed for their statements of having made contact with people. I remember the story of the late George Adamski that stated he made contact in the desert in California in 1952 with a being from another planet. Of course, the man was very brave to make such statements, but I also know that he went through a lot of hell, so to speak, a lot of discomfort of coming out with such information.
There are a lot of stories, and
yes,
some of them are from very, very reliable sources.
Yes,
that indicate this has gone on, and even in the upper levels of military and political life, and not only the United States, but other governments as well.
That's correct.
And my reason for asking that is because I've just met a friend of mine. We've really gotten close over the past couple of weeks, and he grew up in Wyoming, and he tells me that he is a UFO contact. And I was wondering, you know, this is a wild story, and I was just wondering how true this could be.
Well, there's a lot of contact goes on up in Wyoming.
Yeah, well, why don't you take him up there and prove it to you?
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you very much. And I'm afraid we've just about run out of time for our calls, but let's get the address again down, Fred, where we can get your book.
Okay, the book can be ordered from the publisher GAF International, GAF, GAF International, P.O. Box 1722, Vista, V-I-S-T-A, California 92083, and the price is $9.95 plus $1 for postage and handling.
And right now, that's the only place you can get the book is through through that address, but it will be available at bookstores.
Of course, it's out in the catalogs, and it will be available to bookstores in the time to come, but it just came out, so...
I think shipping books will have some down in Orange County. If you're down there, and probably be all around.
Yeah, we'll ship them to them immediately.
Also, if you'd like to get your photograph, Fred was kind enough to drop us off a number of circulars about the book, and it has that startling photograph of the 25-mile-long spacecraft that was taken by NASA, and that's yours simply for dropping a self-addressed stamped envelope to me here at KABC 3321 South La Cienega Boulevard, 90016. And we'll send it back to you, and there's information on how you can get your copy of Fred's delightful book, Alien Bases on the Moon. About 125 rather fascinating photographs in there.
Well, thank you, Bill.
And it's been a fascinating evening, Fred. We'll have to do it again. Yes, so we'll see what kind of update you got on that. Maybe we can even find some more pictures.
Well, I have a few more, but there wasn't enough space to put them all in the book.
Thank you for coming by. Rupert Sheldrake next week on Open Mind. I'll see you then. Night, everyone.
If you're suffering...
Phase 3.
Okay. Okay, yes, the EPS, descent ECA control breaker is closed on 11.
Roger, and how about the, on panel 11, S&C engine control, closed. Half down, Fred.
Okay. We're at Omni, and we have the S&C engine control breaker closed.
Roger. Let's go on with the circuit breaker panel checkup.
Okay, I'll just give you, I think it'll be easier to give you what I got in. Okay, in the top row on 11, we have the four AC bus tie breakers in. And the AC bus bolt breaker in, and that's it. Second row, we have the four TCA breakers in. We have the gas system under flight displays of Commander's FDAI. And likewise, under AC bus A, we have a gas system and a Commander FDAI breaker in. That's it.
Again, just to say that what you're looking at is the mission control room at the Manned Spacecraft Center at Houston. None of us has been in that room tonight. It's obviously difficult to get in there. But NASA this year made a change, and they allowed one reporter, various reporters working on shifts, to be in this room. And I don't think you can see looking at your screen now where our man Roy Neal is, but he is in there. And has been in there for most of this evening during these difficult hours there. And his experience probably is closer to the story and to the problem than anyone else. So we're now going to bring you in Mission Control.
The astronauts in space are now talking to Jack Lausmer in Mission Control, and what they're talking about is making sure that in their rapid motion to turn on the lunar module, Aquarius, that they did it correctly. They're running down the checklist for LEM activation, as they call it. In addition to this, the flight controllers are dictating some corrections as they go. Corrections primarily dictated here because of the need to conserve power. As Lausmer talks, we hear these corrections coming through and we hear him making them to the astronauts. It might be pointed out also that the burn coming up is not to replace the major burn for home, but instead is intended to give the astronauts what they call a free return trajectory. In short, a trajectory that would not allow them to be captured by the lunar gravity. To give them some leeway in this situation. It will not replace the main burn. We still expect that coming up at about 79 hours and 25 minutes. But very shortly now, at 61 hours and 30 minutes approximately, less than an hour from now, they will make a burn of about 16 feet per second, and that should give them a trajectory that will not allow them to be captured by the moon. Much conversation going on between the astronauts and the flight controllers being relayed through Lausmer. The mission control room itself, still a busy place, still filled with people, anxious people working out the systems so that Apollo 13 can be brought safely back to Earth. Roy Neal in Mission Control.
And operate in such a fashion that all the oxygen would go, find that leak, and go on out. At that time, then, we shut off what we call a reactant valves, which are the hydrogen and oxygen to a given fuel cell, in an attempt to stop flow to a position in the plumbing where a leak might be and where all the oxygen might have been going. That actually was to no avail. We did that in each cell, one by one, picking the worst cell first, and at no time did that change the leak rate. And, of course, once we close the reactant valves, we very quickly lose the fuel cell and it is no longer available. We were reluctant to take that step, but it was our last-ditch attempt to isolate a leak. It did not work. At that time, we moved two of the pilots into the lunar module in order to start preparing the vehicle in what I guess we would call a lifeboat mode. We discussed this amongst ourselves in the past, how we would use the lunar module to come on back. Let me say one thing about the trajectory at this time. Of all the times on the way out to the moon, this is probably the most difficult time for a problem like this to occur, because the delta V, or the propulsive maneuver that would be required to come back to Earth directly without going around the moon, had become excessively large. For example, we could have come back with a 6,000 foot per second burn out of the service module. We don't have anywhere near that out of the LEM. But in order to do that, we would have had to dump the lunar module. We would not have been able to get that kind of delta V with the lunar module attached. So that quickly became out of the question with the developing problem we had with the cryogenic oxygen. Quickly, it became clear to us after we had time to review it that the course of action was to retain the lunar module and to swing on around the moon and to prepare to do a maneuver which would, in effect, shorten the return time back to the Earth. We got acquisition, as I said, we moved, two of the pilots moved into the lunar module at about 57 hours and a half, and about 25 minutes later we got acquisition on the LEM, which meant that the telemetry system had been turned on. The first entry to the LEM was primarily one of just making it livable, the batteries, the power, the glycol loop flowing, etc. At this time it was obvious that the command module cryogenics were effectively lost because we had done all that we could. We wanted to retain an alignment on board the lunar module because we knew we had to do a maneuver coming up, and because it is difficult to do alignments with the telescope while you're docked to the CSM. In order to do that, we put a battery on the command service module buses in order to supply some more power. We did this when we figured the fuel cell had just about breathed its last oxygen. We put the battery on and we used it for about 20 minutes perhaps 30 minutes, while we were performing an alignment, which then gave the lunar module a good attitude reference system. The attitude reference system is mandatory to do a proper burn. It's the system that points the vehicle and the engine, and it's the system that then controls the burn. At about 58:40, as I recall, 58 hours and 40 minutes, we turned the command module power down completely and took the battery off the bus. At the very end, prior to putting battery A on the bus, we had used it previously. We charged battery A for a short period of time in the hopes of getting a little more current in. The three entry batteries in the command module, of course, will be the batteries they will use for entry. We will use for entry. And I should say that they're in fine shape. The command module, which is the portion of the vehicle which will re-enter, is, as near as we can tell, in fine shape. We have electrical power. We have a coolant system. We have a command module RCS system, two of them actually. And all the other systems are still in fine shape. We powered the guidance and navigation system down, of course, but we can power that back up prior to entry. At about this time, then, we had to start configuring the lunar module in a fashion that would allow us to fly. We were looking at that, the fact that we knew we had to make a maneuver at about 79 and a half hours, which at that time was about, 19 hours away, and we knew we had to do that on the other side of the moon, so we started to talk about how best to configure the lunar module to get to that point. We did not want to lose the alignment that we had established in the lunar module, and at the other hand, we didn't want to spend too much power because we are fairly limited in the power that we can supply, and the biggest users in the lunar module are the LGC, the computer, and the platform. So we were concerned with that. However, in my mind, we had essentially a safety problem in wanting to retain the platform. We wanted to do as accurate a burn as possible, so that in my mind it was not too much question about turning the platform down as long as we could get enough out of the consumables to safely conduct a burn and use the lunar module as a lifeboat on the way back. Merlin Merritt, who's watching these systems in the lunar module, was very concerned about the status of our consumables at this time, because when we first powered up the lunar module with the coolant system, larger than normal amount of water was being required to cool the vehicle because it had gotten warm, and the initial flow was taking some time to establish an equilibrium, and we at first were looking at fairly high water usage rates. These subsequently slowed down and they continued to get better, and as time went by it became more and more clear that we wanted to leave the computer and the platform up and that we would have the consumables to do the job all the way home, and I'll talk about those towards the end. At about 60 plus 23, we informed the crew that we wanted to perform a free return maneuver very shortly. Now, the logic behind this was that we had the situation which I described in the lunar module, and we had about 19 hours to go to the burn to bring us back home. At that time, without any further maneuver, we would not have been returning to the vicinity of the Earth. So we felt it was wise to spend the time and the consumables at that time to do a small burn. It was about 38 or 40 feet a second, which put us essentially on a free return path back to the Earth. This loops around the moon. We're still not sure of exactly what altitude will go by the moon. We targeted for about 137, and it'll probably be higher than that, although that's still being tracked and worked upon, and I'm sure you'll hear that number in the course of the day. With this decision, we had to go through the checklist to prepare the lunar module for the burn, and we did it not quite as formally, but perhaps as completely as they do at the Cape when they're preparing a vehicle for launch. Fred went through each page. We went down each page, had everybody in the control center agree that we either had to do what was on the page or could delete some of the items. We were interested in deleting what we could, of course, because some of the things use power. And in the situation we were in, it seemed prudent in a number of cases not to use that power for that particular function. We did the burn. The number's all available up here. And the burn went fine. The guidance system performed just fine. And the tracking the Doppler tracking after the burn has all confirmed that the burn was nominal as we had planned, which is another good indicator that the platform or the reference in the lunar module is in good shape. I will review the consumables at the end of this. Let me tell you what is coming up. At the present time, we're in what you might call a modified passive thermal control mode, where usually on the way to the moon, we're rolling the vehicle, and it's standing up. If you look from the Earth to the moon, it's standing up and it's rolling to get a equal temperature distribution from the sun. In this case, what we're doing, since we don't have a good control mode to do that from the lunar module, we're just cycling the vehicle about every hour through 90 degrees so as to equally heat and cool both vehicles, both the command module and the lunar module. That's going very well, and it takes not too much attention on the pilot's part, and we can look at that data on the ground and be sure as we go along that the attitude control system's doing the job. We have had some poorer than usual calm in the last few hours. That's because we've taken a power amplifier, which is essentially just a booster for the calm, and taken it offline, and we've got calm equivalent to what we used to have over some of the ships in the Mercury program. It's saving us 2.5 amps, and at the present time, people are being as stingy as possible about how many amperes or how much current we're using out of the LEM batteries. Looking ahead a little bit, we're expecting to wake up Brad at about 69 hours, and he may be up already, and the other two men are scheduled for about 6 hours sleep. We're looking to do a burn at 79 plus 30, although there's still discussion about doing a little bit early. We have considered and are still considering what the possibilities are for dropping the service module, which is a large amount of weight, in order to accomplish a faster return to Earth with the lunar module engine. There are a number of considerations involved in this, not the least of which is the new thermal environment which the command module heat shield would be exposed to. Of course, it has never flown in space like this. It would have never flown in space like this without the service module on, and there is some concern about what would happen to it if we did not have the service module on there. I say again, the reason for considering dumping the service module is that you can speed up the return and perhaps, and this is really a perhaps, land a day early, but you would end up using just about most of the DIPS fuel, and you would be probably have a little bit less than we would comfortably like to have. I say that this discussion is still going on. These kind of options are still being entertained. And sometime in the next few hours, I expect that we'll decide exactly how we want to do the upcoming burn, and you'll probably hear it on the air to ground at the same time I do. We will probably do something else on the way back after the burn. We'll probably turn down the guidance system on board the lunar module, since it is a fair user of power, and it also has to be cooled, which causes it to use water higher than if we were able to turn it off. The water usage is higher with the guidance system on. We will probably also consider going to a duty cycle on the communication system in order to, again, save power in the lunar module and probably at some point power up the comm on some schedule as opposed to having it up all the time. Those things are in the future, and you'll be hearing more about them. To give you some idea where we stand on the LEM consumables, right now, with the water that we have in the lunar module descent and ascent tanks, we can follow the profile that we have intended to follow, that is powering down the primary guidance system after the first burn, and power it up two more times for MIG courses, and land with still about 12 or 13 hours of water of cooling available. So that is beginning to look like we are in reasonable shape there. We are also studying some ways, possibly getting some more water into the cooling system, and we're not sure how those are going to work yet. On the batteries, we again are planning to follow a course which will end up with about 500 or so amp hours left, which is about 22% of the current or the power available in the lunar module. So that's beginning to look like a fairly comfortable margin. Of course, that is dependent upon following the power profile that we've laid out, and you'll hear people talking about a couple of amps all the way back, and the intention is to follow the profile. I don't have the O2 prediction, but that's generally better than the water and the power. The lithium hydroxide canisters, we have about 50-some hours for the three men with the canisters in the limb, and we are preparing a few techniques for using the canisters and the carbon dioxide scrubbing, which is available in the command service module, and you'll hear some more talk about that on the loop, I'm sure. I think that about summarizes what I can say at first blush, and perhaps my comrades and I can help you with further questions you might have, right?
Separate from the service module, and plus another supply called a repressurization package, which is an additional 3 pounds. This is isolated and is being kept for the entry phase. Now, they are using an oxygen supply presently from the lunar module. And all told, approximately a little over 100 hours of oxygen is left for the mission, which is more than enough.
President Nixon, moving faster than expected, has come up with his 600 miles an hour, which will bring the astronauts back to a landing in the Pacific Ocean on Friday. Mission Control told the spacecraft this evening that it looks in reasonably good shape, and that about sums it up. Things are far from perfect. Some things are still dangerous. But the astronauts now are around the moon and finally on their way home.
I say again that this burn will last about 4 minutes and 20 seconds. It's intended to increase their speed by 850 feet per second, which is about 595 miles an hour. Its real purpose is to adjust their route home. So now let's just listen as the seconds count.
1 minute away now from scheduled time of ignition. Roger. Apollo 13 now 5,426 nautical miles out from the moon, traveling at a speed of 4,552 feet per second. Less than 30 seconds away. The engine is on, standing by. Confirms ignition.
Good.
Well, 40%.
Houston copies.
Burning at 40% of thrust now. They will go up to maximum thrust.
Attitude looks good at this point. Roger.
This burn is likely to last, this will last for about another 4.5 minutes.
Wes Houston, you're looking good. Roger. 1 minute down to the burn.
They are getting on those consoles in Mission Control information on the increased speed of the spacecraft and of its attitude in flight. If it's moving from side to side, they can tell it in this room. And they can tell how much fuel is being expended in this burn of this engine. They can tell the rate at which it's being expended. They know a great deal right there on that floor that you're looking at now about this maneuver being carried on some quarter of a million miles out in space.
Dips is looking good. 2 minutes into the burn.
Have about another 2 minutes and 20 seconds to go if it goes to normally. The dips looking good.
Unless you were looking good at 2 minutes. Still looking good.
2 minutes, Roger.
Velocity building up. Disky shows we've gained 451 feet per second at this time.
It's a little more than half what they wanted. WIPS, of course, means Descent Propulsion System, DPS.
Reports to Flight Director Gene Kranz indicate all systems are looking good. Coming up on 3 minutes into the burn.
Where's your go with 3 minutes? Fire, Roger.
Shows less than a minute to go in the burn now. Coming up on 4 minutes into the burn.
About be setting down.
Shut down.
Shut down. That was Commander Jim Lovell reporting shut down. The engine is off. We're at 79 hours, 32 minutes into the flight.
Well, from what we could hear, it all went perfectly. Burn started on time. Burned as long as it was supposed to. They'll be reading out shortly.
Are you reading 1640, Houston?
Roger, we're reading it.
1230.
They're checking their gauges and dials.
Go down, individuals.
Roger, very small.
Comparing notes with the mission control.
Control. 79 hours, 33 minutes, 5,707 nautical miles out from the moon at this time.
I say that was a good burn. Roger, now you want to power down as soon as possible.
Roger, understand.
Trying to conserve electrical power.
What it means is, it means the crew will get back to Earth 10 hours earlier. But for these men who've gone through that really grueling experience in space, with the limited number of supplies they have aboard the spacecraft, 10 hours is quite a significant amount of time. Don't you think, Frank?
I would want to get back to
79 hours.
Go ahead.
Maybe if you just read off the fingerprint that you wanted to fire down as you did yesterday for us.
Okay, we have a procedure ready to send up to you here.